You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Having some kind of confusion this morning. My guy Cosentini. UA. So, we'll stand by and wait for him. We'll check the news headlines. Make sure I'm calling the right number. I am. It's on him. All right. Good to know. Yeah, I think everybody knows that if you're listening to extended play bumper music, that is probably not a good thing. All right, so we will stand by to hear from Vito. And you know what's going to happen as soon as I get after the headlines? He's going to call, but nonetheless, we'll, being a flexible show host, we continue. We'll check the news headlines if you're just waking up. The United States attacked again by some kind of evidently a terrorist in New York City. He had a pipe bomb. It detonated prematurely. There's pictures of it. You can see it. They have captured the moment that the bomb detonated. And there looks like to be thousands of New York City police officers with rifles, you name it, firefighters, everybody standing by. So New York City, relatively prepared for that kind of stuff. The headlines, Marine Corps headlines around the world today as we get going after a weekend. In flight, fire on an F-35. It's causing anxiety. It's causing anxiety in the world of aviation. An in-flight fire that erupted in an F-35B last year was caused. You know what? I knew it. Joining me is Will Cosentini. Will, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. It's 9:30.
Oh, my bad, my bad, my bad. Can you do this now?
Yeah, hold on. Let me.
You know what? You moved. It didn't translate.
Yeah, Central. Hold on a sec. I got to
get out of bed.
My notes.
Get out of bed.
Got back from the gym, man. Did you watch the Army Navy game?
You know what? I watched parts of it. It was probably one of the best games I've seen in a long time between the two, and they've played some decent ones over the years. But
I thought it may have been the best atmosphere of any game I've ever been at, and undoubtedly. The best atmosphere for an Army-Navy game. It just snow coming down and, evenly matched and going down to the last possession. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
Why do you say the atmosphere? I would think the atmosphere would be relatively constant in the whole thing.
No, it was just the weather really added to it. It wasn't that cold, but just with that snow coming down, it just had a look. It was, it was kind of neat.
Interesting.
I'm digging through here. I was about to be in my prep time, and you preempted me.
Well, like you need any prep time for this subject.
Anyways.
Well, you can continue.
I'll just wing it.
You can continue to look.
Nah, I don't know. I may have left it at my desk at work. That wouldn't help. Or, hold on, I got one other place. Here.
How are things in Missouri?
There we go. I'm in Kansas. We're on the right side of Kansas City here.
So. Oh, really? I didn't know that. I thought you were in Missouri.
Yeah.
You're in Kansas.
Yeah. Yeah, I got my page. I'm all set up.
So is that an annual pilgrimage for you now that you're, or has it been, the Army-Navy game? You get together?
No, it hasn't, because in my previous job, this weekend, in fact, this Saturday, the day of the Army-Navy game, we did a big Toys for Tots thing with the railroad and delivered like $300,000 worth of toys and stuff up and down the line in Florida to the Marine Reservists and Marine Corps League. So that Saturday was always, I was tied up ever since I've been retired. It was a great event, but yeah, prevented me from going. So this is the first time since I retired that I actually was able to go.
Well, that's cool. So do you get to, does your class get together? How does this work for those of us who don't know the social workings of the Naval Academy alumni?
Yeah, so my class, you're 85, so getting old, and also some guys getting rich. So I stayed with a very good friend of mine, Marine, who now teaches at the Lawrenceville School, big-time prep school in New Jersey, about halfway between New York and Philadelphia, maybe a little closer to Philadelphia, probably. So my class on Friday night had a big cocktail party at the top floor of the Mellon Building in downtown Philadelphia.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty swanky.
I would think. Holy smokes.
And then Saturday, typically, I think when the game's in Philadelphia, which is 3 out of every 4 years, the class president would, like, rent out a local bar there and sort of have a tailgate party indoors. For some reason, he wasn't able to make it this year, which is odd because this guy, he lives in Michigan, but he goes every game, just a great guy. So a bunch of us met there. Some people you know.
Really?
Scott Sobka was there, sends his regards, says he listens to the program every once in a while.
Hans Stuka. Scott Sobka is a big Polish guy.
Yeah.
And
yeah, he's doing real well.
Smart and tough, went to work for Frito-Lay. I think he has a son that served in the Navy. And Scott was that rare combination of, like, brute force, born and raised in New Jersey. In fact, this tallest structure in New Jersey is the Water Sphere in Union, New Jersey. Ask me how I know that. Well, people from New Jersey keep track of things like this. Yeah, they do. And he'd come home from driving home to New Jersey. He said, you know what? I don't know what this thing is about New Jersey. It's like I get there, and the guy in the toll booth to go into New Jersey looking at me like he's going to kick my ass. And now you're sitting a Monday morning. He and his wife went home, and, you know, just with their kids to see parents and stuff. And you're sitting there getting ready to do some problem in the woods on Monday morning, trying to keep the water off your boots for as long as you can. And you're listening to him like, are you sure that the guy looked at you like you wanted to kick you? Oh, it's a Jersey thing, man. Everybody's got to kick somebody else's ass. And he was like totally about it. Like, if the guy would have, like, wanted to fight him, Scott would have fought him at the entrance to the tollway. Horns honking, anyway. But no, he's a smart, smart guy, and he's a good dude. So Scott Sobka. Well, that's good. Was he in your class?
He was.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
We knew each other well.
I didn't know that. Big time Polish guy, too.
Yeah, Dad was a plumber. He was the loose head prop on the A-side rugby team, lettered probably 3 or 4 times. Great guy.
Wow.
Great guy.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's good.
Yes, we met up with some people before the game, and then walked down to the game, and I went over just before halftime. I saw the chairman.
Oh, you did?
And the commandant, and they were suffering. You know, it was that heavy, wet snow coming down, and they were in alphas. And so that snow was, like, piled up on the top of the cover, and then it would melt and leak into the inside of your cover and run down your head.
Exactly.
But they were in great spirits, and, you know, it was good. It was fun. My son was with me. So General Dunford's a big fan of my son for some reason, former Marine sergeant when he got out. And I talked to him for a while, and then he had to go do prisoner exchange and go sit on the other side after halftime and – talked to the commandant for about 10 minutes. He seemed in good spirits, and it was good. It was great. It was a great time.
All right. Well, that's all. No, you know, the game itself was a man's game, too. It was smash it. It was good. And the way they, you know, again, the way they play the game hard and then without the rest of the nonsense makes you smile when you watch it. It's the way it should be.
Yeah, I think that there was 4 penalties the whole game.
Yeah.
Navy had 2 on that very last drive.
Right.
And I'll tell you, kicking a 49-yard field goal in the snow, if that thing would have been through, I mean, the guy wouldn't have bought a drink for the rest of his life.
Let me tell you, he should have got a point and a half just because he came
got
within.
There.
Yeah, just because I thought there's no way this thing's even going to get there. And then all of a sudden he boosts it, and you're like, oh, my God. And then it goes wide left.
Well,
and you're like, oh.
We were sitting on the 40-yard line 22 rows back. And when he kicked it, we were like, oh, it ain't going to get there. But it just kept going and going.
Right.
And then because of the angle, we thought it went through.
Oh, yeah.
But then the people down the sideline, they had a much better view of it than we did. So it was only just for a fleeting moment I thought it went through. And then Army stormed the field.
And that was your indication. That was your indication.
Your arch rival.
That was your indication that it hadn't gone through?
Yeah. I'd say for Army. You play your arch rival. you never storm the field. Right? You expect to win against your arch rival.
Oh.
So,
yeah, but
my only criticism.
They've had it rough over the last, what, 15 years?
Yeah, I think they're 1-15. Now they're 2-15 in the last 17.
So we can forgive them for youthful indiscretion. I mean, right? When it comes more infrequently than leap year, come on, you've got to give them a little bit of a right. And because this one, the second one, was to validate that last year wasn't a freak, and that they were legit, that Army's back, and so.
Anyway,
all right. Let's talk about one of the more interesting things to consider relative to leadership. And I've always been a fan, and as Will has, of institutional leadership, organizational leadership, and then very parochially in the Marine Corps, and then and in the Department of the Navy. And so, first of all, Will is retired as just give us 60 seconds on your career, so people that I think everybody knows you, but just in case you're more than railroad man, okay? So just tell everybody that you are.
Graduated from Navy in '85, infantry officer. I commanded 1st LAR in 2004 or 2005 time period, and OAF 2 TAC 1, I think we called it. I got about 2 years sea time on 3 med floats. Finished up as the military assistant to the assistant commandant for Generals Amos, Dunford, and Paxton, and retired summer of 13.
All right, and so now he's in the railroad business. Okay, where do you want to start this conversation? You said you had some notes. Your thoughts on watching this, obviously painful.
Yeah, you know, and I listened to your conversation with General Droughty and with Woody last week, and I don't necessarily disagree with most of what they said, but I would take it in a slightly different direction. You know, I think that there's been, you know, there's INW about the Navy for a long time. And the most recent events maybe show some very acute failures. But I think that they've had some institutional problems on trying to figure out what they are. I mean, remember when they had that miniature surrender in the Persian Gulf?
Yes.
That should terrify Navy leadership. You look at random photographs of Navy ships at sea. You got plenty of sea time. I got some sea time. Compare photographs of Navy ships at sea over the last 3 or 4 decades. And you see neglect of ships at sea. And part of that, I think, is manning levels. And, you know, did the Navy attempt to go for an efficiency or an effectiveness way ahead? And I think they tried to pick efficiency because they're machine-oriented. And I think it's always been a very strong part of the Navy culture that it's the machine, you know, you fight the ship.
Right.
But that being said, you know, Nelson, he fought the ships, and what did he say? He said, you can, paraphrasing, no captain can do wrong who puts his ship alongside that of the enemy. You know, Ernest Evans fought his ship, the USS Johnson at Lady Gulf. He spots a Japanese battle line coming at him, and he gives command, left full rudder, all head flank, prepare to engage. Look, when I was a first lieutenant on board USS Spartanburg County, we did a change of command of the ship in Izmir, and then we went down to Egypt, and this was 1989, manned the U.S. Marines in Egypt for I don't know when, if ever. And we did a little amphibious one-ship landing using charts that were 25 years old. And sort of very hazy reef lines out there. and the CO of the ship had been in command for about 2 weeks. He put a guy out in a whaleboat, and he had a guy with a sounding line on the bow of the ship, and he took that thing into like 700 yards offshore. I mean, so you can fight the ship, but also have a fighting spirit about it. I just don't know if they have that attitude about it now. They've made institutional decisions. The whole LCS thing is just, it's horrible. This Fat Albert controversy out there, she was a real rot in the senior leadership. And so I don't know if they've gone over, and it's not obvious to me that they really look deep inside and say it's the people that matter. And that's bad because the equipment can't win, right? Only the people can win. Or our warfighting doctrine is completely wrong.
Right.
We believe the way we think. You have to have the people. The moral is to the physical is 3 to 1. You have to have that. And yeah, it's bad. I mean, look, I'm not a Navy basher. This is my favorite Navy in the whole world.
Right.
Right?
Of all of them. I love this one.
We gotta have it.
Right.
We gotta have it.
Well, and, okay, so let's talk about the institution. Let's talk about, because when you, I mean, the Fat Albert thing, you know, again, I would liken that to sexual harassment. I would liken that to Matt Lauer. It's not like nobody knew that there wasn't icky stuff going on, and this guy, and I won't go so far as say hiding in plain sight, but I don't think for the people that worked out there, I don't think anybody's surprised that this stuff, I think they're surprised that guys are being brought up on charges and whatnot, but it was an open secret. It was the way we did business. It was who we got in bed with, which is an institutional comment on Navy. The Persian Gulf surrender, and I would even amplify it beyond the surrender, it is what is going to happen, what is going to have to happen in the Persian Gulf for a captain of a United States naval warship to defend the ship against these stupid Iranian events at sea. Is it gonna take that a United States, before a United States naval warship will say fire, that American sailors have to get killed? Is that what it's gonna take?
Yeah.
Because that's bullshit. Because you not only have the right, you have the duty to defend your ship and those sailors that go to sea. And it doesn't seem like the Navy understands that. I would draw another circle around the entire culture of the SEALs and what has gone on there. And then there's all the incidents in the 7th Fleet. And the reason why would we devote time to this on All Marine Radio? If we in the Marine Corps, just like when Marines United happened, if the other services don't look at that and say, I know we have the same stuff going on. I mean, the Marines are special, but they're not that special. They're the same stupid teenagers that walked in that are doing this that we have in our branch of the service, and we need to go start peeling the onion and finding out if we're involved in this, if we have the mechanisms to address it, and we need to get after it right now before we get drugged through the streets like Neller's getting drugged through the Senate Armed Service Committee today.
Let me counter that just a little bit.
Okay.
I would say a lot of these failures in the Navy are at the leadership level, though. Persian Gulf surrender, you know, there's at least a first class, if not a chief, and there's a lieutenant out there. So he's what, 6, 7, 8 year veteran.
Right.
The Fat Albert thing is all senior people. I think the SEALs haven't gone from swift, silent, deadly to not quite silent. That's part of an expansion of the force. But those are senior petty officer, type people in these collisions, like it or not, that's COs, XOs, officers of the day, you know, senior chief, quartermaster on the bridge, first class quartermaster on the bridge, first class bosun mate on the bridge. Those are those guys, up there. That isn't, you know, a series of events where a bunch of E2s and E3s conspired to have that ship collide with something else.
Right.
So I think it's a little bit different. And, you know, to me, I wrote down two things here. You know, interestingly, during the war, the last, whatever, 10 or 15 years, when I went to the Naval Academy, it was capped at 16 2/3% of the class could go through the Marine Corps. Well, we've been taking 25% out, Marines out of the Naval Academy for several years. I don't know what it's been in the last couple, but I know in the time period 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 classes, we're taking 25%. So what that tells me is that at the entry level, that the people are there to fight, right? And then your class in 2007 at the Naval Academy, and you want to go be a Marine, that means you want to go fight.
Right.
So 25% of that class has they want it, but it's not clear at the senior level that they know and they want it and they know how to lead it. You know, the other thing, I try not to be in the habit of quoting General Mattis, but, you know, very strong statement, brilliance in the basics.
Right.
What are the basics in the Navy? I don't think they're really hard to parse out. But at some point, who is looking someone else in the eye and telling them what to do and then make sure that they do it? What are those fundamentals? And those fundamentals at a senior leadership level, fundamentals of like don't take grafts, fundamentals at a watchstanding level.
I've read a paper. I don't know if I sent it to you, but it's written by a recently retired surface warfare officer / Black Shoe Navy guy. And he said, hey, look, I've been involved in programs my entire life and operations my entire life. If you want to put the majority of emphasis on sexual harassment, sexual assault, and social engineering, then you'll get a force adept at that. If you want to have a force that's adept at operations, you'll get a force adept at that. And so give me your thoughts on the Navy. I mean, even in the closing years of your career, you got to see you worked in the rarefied air of the Marine Corps, and certainly got a chance to see the Department of the Navy. We're talking about leadership, not only, you know, the Fat Albert stuff and in terms of corruption and in terms of Navy sustainment, but, you know, the Persian Gulf incident. But to me, the most disturbing, the SEALs to me are need to be, somebody needs to rein them in. I think it's a sick organization. That's my personal thought. And that's both. And I think that operationally and cosmetically, you never read about Delta Force. You just don't. So to finish my point, and then the stuff in the Seventh Fleet, you're talking about ineptitude to the point where, probably you're going to hit another vessel, like what, 2-3 minutes out? We're not, and the rest is just closing and smacking, but they're big structures, and we're going to hit. And nobody can hit the collision alarm. Nobody has a good sense to go to general quarters. And we're talking about the Champlain. We're talking about the Fitz, and we're talking about the McCain. That these guys shouldn't have been crushed in their racks while they slept. And you don't need a whole – when you hear general quarters and you're asleep, believe me, your ass vaults out of that rack. And it doesn't take very long for you to get up that ladder well and get your ass moving. After you grab your boots and your pants, you go. That's the kind of ineptitude that we're talking about, Will. That's not insignificant. That is hugely incompetent.
Yeah. Listen, I think that Ray Mabus was poisonous to the Navy as a SecNav. And he had a very strong attitude that we're going to change the culture around here. And I'm not sure what he thought the culture was when he went in, 2008 time period. But it became a very sissified, pussified culture, at least at the secretariat level, and it became a very political, and by that I mean the dirtiest kind of political attitude within that office. You know, he had typically in the secretary's office, he's got a senior Navy aide, senior Marine aide. Not, they're not aides; they're, you know, 06 level, and the senior one is the one that runs that office. And Mabus brought in a political guy, got him appointed to be an SES, and pushed the uniforms further out into the office, and that sends a pretty strong message about a lot of things there. And there's just a lot of political hackery, that went on in that office. And I mean, simple stuff. Look, you want to name a ship after Gabby Giffords, right? That sends a very strong message out to the Navy.
Right.
Like it or not. And I fault a guy like Bob Work, you know, retired colonel, was the undersecretary of the Navy, and wrote a 60-page paper justifying some of that stupidity. And so if you don't lead, I don't think anyone looked at Ray Mabus as a man of strong integrity who genuinely cared about the defense of the nation and the performance of the Navy. I don't think there's anyone in the department that looked at him that way. And so, you know, you're going to get the performance, that the leader is looking for. Look at how ships operate today. Ships in World War II, yeah, we're going to go close combat with the enemy. That was the beginning of the war, then the kamikazes and all that stuff. But you had to be able to fight the ship. You had to be able to do damage control and everything else. You look at the Stark in the 80s, missile comes out of nowhere. Some other incidents. Being in the Navy can be a brute force type existence, right? You got a hole in the side of the ship below the waterline. There's no technical solution to that.
For those of us who've ever been to sea, I mean, one of the things the Marines used to love the most, because it was the most physical, was going to damage control school. And, you know, we'd send them before the deployments, you know, we'd get our groups and we'd send them through that stuff. And they'd come back. They're like, oh, sir, it's awesome, man. When you do the firefighting or when you do shoring up a wall and there's water everywhere, you know, and Corporal so-and-so, Corporal Campbell is a big, you know, he's like Sobka, right? He's Hercules in a uniform. He's like, oh, he grabbed this 4x4 and he stuffed it and he's screaming at people and they're laughing. Sir is awesome, but it is straight up brute force strength. And if you read in the reports following the Fitzgerald and the McCain's collision, it's not at the lower ranks that the Navy's got issues. Those guys, they fought their ship, you know, the damage control fight, like men, okay, like men and women. I mean, they got after it. So that's not where the Navy's got issues. And it's just, let me ask you this. How big of an impact do you think the Mabus thing had on the leadership of the Navy in terms of what's important to the Navy? Do you see them?
Yeah, I think it's huge.
Because here's what I would tell you.
Our fear of leadership doesn't mean anything.
Right. Here's what I would tell you, though. We are a culture that we don't like. Kids don't stay back anymore in high school. We're not comfortable as adults enforcing standards that cause people to fail. We don't do it anymore. And so we do that in our school districts, but we don't do that in the military? And might this stuff be creeping in? So that we become soft, accepting, force preservation boards instead of, hey, get them out of here, that we want to be, you know, a social engineering organization more than a warfighting organization. And so to me, that is the general culture that Ray Mabus exists inside of, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And championed.
Yes. And so if you're a CO, if you're a you know, a fleet admiral, whatever the hell they call those guys, if you're head of the 7th Fleet when you look at Ray Mabus, you look at the things you're responsible, sexual assault, sexual harassment, the social piece of this, and I begin to rack and stack and prioritize, they can go out without their nav quals, without their engineering quals, but I'll tell you what, damn it, everybody better have their sexual harassment, sexual assault, because that's what's important in this Navy. Is that, has it got to that point?
I mean, I don't, to me that's a little bit of an excuse, because in the end, you know, if you're going to look people in the eye and you're responsible for their life and death, you better figure out. Because, look, we had to do all that crap before we deployed, right? And you were given a checklist that had 200 things on it, and you can only do 100 of them. But the general told you to do all 200. Yeah, you got to pick. Maybe some of that emphasis. I don't know I think that attitude hurts more than the actual things that you have to do.
Right.
I'd say this whole sleep deprivation discussion that went on, you know, last week.
McCain
loves it. The Navy's been sleep deprived forever. I don't buy that as the proximate cause. If that would have happened, we would have been having these incidents over and over and over again. Because, right, the watch bill hasn't changed.
Well, you know, Will, let me ask you this. You know, 100-hour work week. Right, in combat, that's 14.36 hours a day. Would you have signed up for that?
Yeah, I'm the best rep battalion commander in Iraq.
I was watching McCain one day, and I'm hearing these 100-hour work weeks have to stop. And I thought, well, wait a minute, what the fuck else do you do when you're deployed? You work. And if it 14 hours a day of work still gives you 10 days to go 10 hours to go do other things. And so this is my take, and I quote Eric Smith from an interview I did with him in Ramadi in 2005. And it was on in Ramadi. He was a CO-15, and we had served together on the staff of the division and were friends and still are. And so I said, hey, would you come on? And so we're talking, and he goes, well, my job here, he said, my job is to give these Marines what they need. Okay, what they need to come back, and they need to eat, they need to drink fluids, they need to PM the vehicles, they need to fill sandbags, they need to clean their weapons, they need to clean their cruisers, and they need to clean up their general area, because we don't live like pigs. And then after that, they need to go sleep. What they want to do, they want to go down to the Game Boy suite room, and they want to spend all night there playing video games. That's what they want to do. And then drag their sorry asses out with dirty weapons and vehicles that don't work and pray for the best. He said, that doesn't happen here. He said, because we're on it. And so to me, you have all those distractions now when you go to sea. You used to be able to read, okay? And that was about it. Because the ship store accommodated 10 people at a time. There was no internet. And so you would read, or you would sit there and watch movies on the ship's movie station, or you would trade VHS tapes with other people and maybe watch a movie before you fell asleep. That's what it used to be. But now there's distractions galore. You can get on the internet. You can chat with your wife or your girl or with both of them. You can go ahead and, yeah, you can go
maybe
ahead.
They never meet.
Exactly. And then you can go and play in your Madden NFL league that you need to catch up on. And so to me, even if somebody is tired, you know, Senior Chief Cosentini is supposed to be in the vicinity and look at me and say, McNamara, why are you sleeping? Like, I had to catch up on my NFL league games last night. And then Cosentini says, get his ass off the bridge, go get me so-and-so, you go to sleep, and I'm going to see you at 1800 tonight in my office. You got it? That's leadership, right? So this whole notion of 100 hours is bullshit. What else are you doing besides work?
Yeah.
And then 14 hours a day? It's a joke.
Look, we you know, first LER, the most critical man on the vehicle is the driver. Right, so if the driver is not well rested, and we operated pretty continuously. I typically, you know, line companies were first couple of months we were there, were 29 nights out of 30 in the desert. We didn't have time to be in a fob.
Okay,
and,
so,
and I was
so let me ask you this.
Pretty insistent about let drivers.
Me, let me ask you this, please. Will. So to do that, to spend that much time operating outside the wire, what were the keys to keeping people effective?
Yeah, and I, again, brilliance in the basics, right? It's a fundamental. It's PM your vehicle, keep track of your equipment, make sure people drink their water, and think through your operation, because people do have to sleep. And for me, it was a little bit odd. You know, you're out there with your jump, you're the battalion commander, but you're also a platoon commander. So I had that. But more of it was I tried not to spend a lot of time supervising PSCs and Marine Corps, but I was a bit of a psychopath. I know it's hard to believe. Mm-hmm. With staff sergeants, lieutenants, captains, gunnies. Try and paint the picture of how this thing's got to go, give them the map on how we're going to break down what we're doing, what our priorities are, and make sure that they go get it. And, you know, I take a lot of pride in what that unit did. Some things that I took a lot of pride in. We never took a casualty in a fixed position. So to me, that means our security was pretty good.
Right.
We took our casualties on the move. After probably the first 3 weeks we were there, we had, if I can remember, one vehicle accident, and it was a systemic failure of sleep, and some people were concerned that I was going to send them home. I mean, I was absolutely beside myself because I had laid out and thought I'd supervised properly. So it took a lot of pride in that we did not have a steady drip of non-battle injuries. It took us about 3 weeks to get our head out of our ass, but after that, you know, we learned. Yeah. Same thing with vehicles. I think we blew two engines in the first 2 weeks. At bad PM.
Right.
But after that, we didn't lose a vehicle. In fact, we put a lot of vehicles back in action from combat casualties that didn't think we're going to be able to happen. Guys welding transmissions in the middle of the night. And so, but those are the basics. And I can't remember sending a guy home sick. I can't remember a heat casualty. You know, we were there summer of 2004. So to me, those are pretty fundamental brilliance in the basic type stuff.
Okay, let me read you an email, and then we have to take a break, and then I want to hear your then I want you to begin to provide a solution for us. Here's the email. In case you two menses haven't figured it out yet, for those of you who don't know, a Mensa is I'm not exactly sure what the acronym is, but it's for really, really smart people, okay? I don't think that's a compliment the way he says it. In case you two menses haven't figured it out, we're talking about discipline. Mac, you just talked about Lieutenant Colonel Eric Smith, and I'm listening to your Italian friend talk about what he did to operate that often outside of the wire. It's discipline. It all comes back to discipline. We as a culture hate it, but the only way to success is through it. The Navy has turned its back on it, and I know the Navy's not the Marine Corps, but the Navy used to be a badass place. It used to be a seagoing tough guy place. And the chiefs in the Navy were tough, tough guys. They knew those ships like they knew the back of their hand, and they ran that stuff hard. Mac, you were talking about junior officers last week, and you read an email. That email has been the way of the Navy, which is it annihilates junior officers. You get to the fleet, you have to get OOD qualified along with learning your day job. It's a lot. If you can't handle it, then you get kicked to the curb. It's not a very welcoming place. And I do believe they need something like the basic school. But it's discipline. Our culture is dying because of it. You have young people literally dying because schools won't embrace it. And it's seeping into the military. The RAND Mensa's issued a report last week saying that the United States would be in jeopardy of having their asses kicked by Russia or China. I didn't read the whole thing, saw a headline, intend to read it this week. That's downright scary. There's no way that either one of those countries ought to be able to get into our ass. Bloody our nose? Yes. Dislocate our jaw? Probably. But kick our ass? Never. We need to get our heads out of our ass. Thank God we have a guy as Sekta who speaks the truth. At least that's my experience. And hopefully we'll get this done. I am glad the Navy has very publicly gone through what they're going through because it will get fixed. There's no doubt in my mind. But it's about discipline. And if the Navy won't embrace discipline again like they used to, we'll see more of this. And we'll see more of it in any service that doesn't embrace discipline. Because this generation needs more of it, not less. They need more structure, more discipline, because they come from a world that doesn't believe in it. And we can't leave them on their own. I will leave it at that. You guys have my blood boiling. Thank you very much. All right, all right, so write a couple notes down, and when we come back, I'll tell you what it is. I do believe that, though. I mean, you know, think about the macro. You're going to come from a culture that doesn't embrace discipline into a culture that does, and then we say the change is forever. Well, how do we make sure it's forever? By allowing you to decorate your room any way you want to, by not having field day anymore. It's just kind of a cleanup. By not inspecting field day. And that's why I say we have an institutional problem, because we don't want to enforce our own standards that we know are timeless in terms of, you know, preparing for combat. And so, anyway, let me take a break. We come back, and then you're going to roll out your solution. Are you a Mensa? Yeah. You're a smart guy. Are you a Mensa?
I'm not a Mensa.
All right. And just so you know,
and I'll never be. And after that last email, I'll never be a Mensa.
Exactly. More of All Marine Radio. Well, we're going to take about 4 minutes. Coming up next, Will Cosentini, United States Naval Academy, class of 1985? 85. Classmate of Scott Sobka, also known as Hans Stuka. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you viewers, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts at 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsouthfoundation.org/Marine.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue on a Monday. We're talking leadership this morning. Specifically, we're talking about leadership in the United States Navy. Will Cosentini, United States Naval Academy class of 1985, joins me. And he attended the Army-Navy game over the weekend. We're excited about that. And but also retired as a colonel, United States Marine Corps, was the assistant, what do you call that? Executive assistant? MILSAC? What
military, we were the military assistant.
The military assistant. And what does that do? For three of the last four, except the most recent ACMAC, the three before that. So, he's got to see some stuff in his life. Also got to command 1st Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion, in OIF 2, 2TAC-1, I think is what. I couldn't remember what we called it, but not the March up.
It was 2TAC-1 back then.
Yeah, but it was the time of the year when Al Anbar literally exploded in 2004. So Will was out commanding and all of that. So let me, what's your solution? How does this issue of, it's to me, Twin Towers, it's discipline, it's leadership, and it's a culture that's kind of strayed from its historical roots. How do you get it back?
Yeah. So trying to understand the problem, you know, if you're the senior leadership in the Navy and you look at what are my top problems going forward and senior leadership, like 4-star, secretary, undersecretary level, I think what your problems are is Ohio class replacement, you know, huge bow wave of money, got to go that way.
Right.
I need the whole F-35, F-18, what's going on with tactical aviation. Big deal. I think LCS, you know, is this thing going to work like we think? Are we going to be able to rotate the crews? Are we going to get the blah, blah, blah? So, you know, you're looking at platform are really your issues, huge capital investment. In a lot of ways, that's what they have to look at. So if there's another problem, you know, we've got to be able to define it. And can we look deep inside ourselves and believe that we think we're getting the right people, but it's not necessarily clear we're getting the performance we want out of those people. So why is that? Is there a training issue, leadership issue, et cetera? And I got to tell you, if I was in the Navy, I would attempt to look for where are we successful. And I think you look at my submarine program. I think they're successful in that. It's very regimented. They get high-quality people into it. They have very high standards, at least in, you know, my experience many years ago dealing with people like that. They were not afraid to send people home. Can you take things out of that model so that you're fitting a very technical, you know, platform-based, you know, nuclear submarine, but also getting people to perform at a very, very high level, which I think they did, particularly at the height of the Cold War, within that submarine force. Because, look, they're not going to adopt Paris Island.
Right.
They wouldn't want them to. But there's something inside there that balances. And look, you want to talk about discipline? Being on a nuclear submarine. Discipline, right?
Right. You have to have
it. Couple hundred feet under the water. You know, you can screw that up pretty quick. So maybe that's a model of training and discipline that fits the platform-based, systems-based Navy. Now, can you pull it off at a much grander scale than you do within the submarine community? I don't know, but maybe you don't have to have that.
You don't have a choice now. I mean, anything that the Navy thought that it could do internal to the Navy to fix this is gone by the wayside. You are now going to get oversight and rudder steer from a guy whose call sign is chaos.
Yeah, the thing that I would avoid is attempting to solve the problem without understanding.
Look,
when a senator says, "Oh, you got a sleep problem," what's the problem?
Yeah.
How do you define the problem? Right? It's easy to take a solution and ram it down, but we don't want to be iterating all too much here. We want to fundamentally understand the problem. Now, they should have, contrary to the days with Secretary Mabus, they should have an environment today where the SECNAV should be able to have a discussion with the SECDEF concerning here's how I'm going to attempt to figure out how to define this problem, and then here's my go forward with that. But don't forget, the overwhelming conversation inside the building is about budget.
Right. So when we look at the Navy, all right, if I broke it down into their culture, their personnel, and their equipment and leadership, if I look at those four categories, what has to change in each one? And I completely agree with you. You know, you essentially define the solution in the definition of the problem. If we include this but not this, then guess what? Then that isn't involved in the solution. So
yeah. So the,
yeah. Talk to me. Talk to me about the. So how do? What do you? So let's do hierarchy. If you take those four categories: culture, leadership, equipment, and personnel. What is? Can you rank those 1 to 4, or is that inappropriate?
Just go to equipment, right? So
okay.
The Ohio class imperative, the Ohio class replacement's an imperative. It's a part of strategic triad. And that budget, like I don't know what the Navy's budget is, $100 and something billion a year. And if that Ohio class replacement price goes up, it's not like the budget increases. It just means that everything else goes down, because that's going to be their number one priority. So I don't know if there's a way to fence that from the Navy budget, that pure CapEx. I don't know.
Because that, I mean, that the Ohio class budget even has implications for the Marine Corps.
Absolutely.
In terms of sucking the life and the oxygen out of the room. And so, so let me ask you a question about procurement relative to these kind of issues, because this is the second week in a row that the Ohio class submarine buy that's on the horizon has come up. The Navy seems to have a penchant for as much technology as possible and fewer platforms, and it seems to me we're buying a Navy that's too high end and not enough platforms, in that we're going to have this small Navy where the rubber band, and it's what we have now, where the rubber band is stretched tight, and then we're going to, and we all know from our time in the Marine Corps, nobody says no to commitments, and that rubber band is going to go extremely fast, and it's going to sound like this. Until it goes snap, and so I don't know if we're seeing it go snap yet. We're seeing failures in it, certainly, but I don't think we're seeing it snap. But I just,
there's a famous chart inside the Pentagon that shows you that, I don't know how far into the future, but basically the way aviation costs go up,
right,
in the future you're going to be able to buy one airplane with your entire budget. You know, if we keep adding more technology. And that's a natural evolution, right? 15 years ago, it cost us $1,500 to outfit an individual Marine. Now it costs us $15,000. 15 years ago, a Humvee cost, whatever, $50,000-$60,000. Now a JLTV costs $350,000.
Yeah, think about that. Think about that when you think about our budgets. But when you look at number of ships, and you go through that, I read.
So that's a SecDef problem, though.
Right?
That's
a
SecDef.
I agree.
Well, that's not a Navy problem.
Right.
That's a SecDef problem. And I would say the president, unfortunately, you know, when he comes out and talks about we're going to have this size Navy, it's a wonderful thing, except for how you think you're going to get there. Well, it's obvious you can't buy modern platforms to make a 350-ship Navy or whatever it is. So what are you going to take stuff out of the ghost fleet that's sitting, you know, in the Schuylkill River outside of Philadelphia? So now you've got a huge manning problem, and you've got a technologically insufficient Navy.
Right.
So that's a very, very hard circle, you know, to square up, but that's a SecDef president level policy. If you want to do math, you can do it from the top down or the bottom up. If you do it from the bottom up, here's the platforms, here's their deployment, capability. So here's what we can actually put out in the front line. And so what areas are we going to economy of force? And you got to be willing to take that risk. There's not a problem. There's a risk. That's what you're paid to do. But if you top down it and say, we're going to do all these different things, right? We got to have presence here, presence here, presence here, presence here, presence here. When you add the math up, you know, you need a 900 ship Navy. And then you dump it on the lap of the CNO, to figure that out. Well, you're going to be doing stupid stuff. You're going to be keeping, you know, ships forward deployed all the time and rotating crews. So you have this huge learning curve every time you go out. The ship will never properly be maintained. You won't get your 25-year life out of it. So at the policy level, you can do things, but there's risk.
Okay. All right. So that's equipment. But to me, that's where we're at now. You know, the F-35,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's great. It's a transformational air platform. But
you're going to have four of them.
Yeah, we're going to have four of them, and that's not enough. And at some point, I think, as a nation, unless the budget's going to be expanded incredibly, we have to come to grips with the fact that we need this many platforms. So reverse engineer it from the final number, right, and make sure you only take 75% of the final number, because we know the cost overruns are going to have to be included in it.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
And,
right.
And personnel, I don't buy this millennial generation crap. and I may be out of date.
No, you're right. I don't either. They're a blank canvas. Right?
In 2004, I never saw a Marine hesitate.
Yeah, no, they're blank canvas.
So the personnel side of it, as long as you recruit, you should do quality recruiting. We only want high school graduates. We don't want people that got felonies. We don't want dopers. You know, we don't want the next Bradley Manning. We should be man enough to say we're not going to do that. And those people will, the people that come to us, even the people that go to the Navy, you can make them into the force. So this, yeah, you got to understand people, how they are, but the idea that, well, the millennials, they need all this, and they're like, that's bullshit. The people that walk in that recruiter's door, you can get them, if you give them what they actually expected when they walk through the door, then they will perform. So I'm gonna take that off the table. Now, culture and leadership,
Well, let me just tell you, the problem, let me make a comment about personnel. The problem with personnel isn't the blank canvas that walks through the door. It's the people in the institution that don't want to hold them accountable to historical norms of discipline. They're the problem. So it's the parents. It's not the kids. The kids are awesome, and they're capable of anything, as we've seen over and over again in combat. But if you have people that think it's, oh, that's too hard, oh, well, we have to make it easier, you don't. You can't. You don't set them up for success under the most difficult circumstances when you do that. You need to make it consistent. You need to make it rigorous. You need to inspect. You need to give them the structure and the leadership. And if you do this, just like it has been for decades and generations in the American military, and I won't talk about any other military, they will deliver what you need. But
that little surrender in the Persian Gulf is a wonderful case study. If that lieutenant, maybe he was put in a bad place, and maybe he was outgunned. But if he would have said, stand by to engage, those guys on those 40s and 50 cals, they would have gone to condition one and be ready to squeeze the trigger. They weren't the ones that quit.
Right.
The failure was at the leadership.
Right.
Yeah, so how can the Navy look inside itself and say, is our leadership culture suitable? And again, I think there's a lot of rot in there. And there's been a lot of rot for a long time in there. And that's going to be the most challenging thing. That's the thing that the secretary has got to shape the senior admirals. You know, the secretary is the one that's picking the 3 stars and the 4 stars. Those are non-statutory boards. He's got to pick people. They got to get a sense of integrity back into the force, both after the Fat Albert stuff and any of the Mavisisms. And it ain't going to happen tomorrow. If the secretary comes out and lays out, here's what I think the problem is, and he doesn't have a one-stop solution, because a one-stop solution ain't going to work. You know, if it's another, we got to do a brief on this, it's just one more piece of bullshit that people will ignore. But is he willing to look deep inside and say, we've got flawed leadership at a very senior level, and do that publicly?
Let's talk about that. If you were CNO, and I'll be
CNO is part of the problem.
Okay, but you're a CNO, and I'm gonna be Secretary Mattis. I would look at you, and you'd show up, and there wouldn't be a whole lot of camaraderie and cajoling before this meeting. I would have my little notebook in front of me, and I'd look across the table and say, "Well, we've got a problem." And I'm going to give you Secretary of Defense, I've heard him do it, and he'll say it something like this: I'm going to give you a chance to solve this thing, okay? But I need to see results in a hurry. I need the stupid stuff to stop, and I'm going to give you a little Matticism, all right? Brilliant in the basics. You need to operate your ships, your machinery professionally, okay? And so I will leave you with that. That's what I expect. Operate them professionally. So how would you go about You know, we've talked about, I don't want to talk about equipment because that's a different discussion.
Yeah.
I want to talk about culture, personnel, and leadership. How do you do it with it?
Yeah, so first of all, Mattis would have the secretary and the CIO in there.
Right.
He wouldn't have it with just a service chief. I think that they've done some very traditional Navy things that aren't bad things. People get fired, right? Senior leaders got, they fired a 3-star. That's big news. But the way it's going to get shaped, it's going to get shaped in maybe in two ways. Way number one is as a secretary shapes the 3 and 4 stars in the Navy, but that takes 2 to 3 years to shape that, and maybe longer because the bench may be really skinny. And the second way is, let's look inside ourselves. What do we do successfully within the Navy culture and the Navy constraints of equipment and everything else? And how do we get away from having a submarine silo and a surface silo and an aviation silo and special warfare silo? And how do we genuinely take the best in breed from those things and turn it into a Navy and not communities? You know, if it comes from the submarines, I don't know if it's poisonous to the surface.
Right, that's tough.
Part of the Navy.
Well, again, the surface can draw on its own greatness, right?
I don't know if it can now. I genuinely don't know.
But ultimately, it can turn it towards its own greatness if it embraces, you know, again, let's use the subs, subculture. You don't have to go down the sub road before you can quickly look at your own greatness. You know, it astounds a lot of people.
Yeah.
The number two, you know, casualty absorbing service in World War II, United States Navy. Yeah. I mean, the Navy got it on in World War II. I mean, it's filled with greatness. So to me, I don't know that you need to go down in any other road, but you need to have the people that can take it down that road and can enthusiastically and relentlessly pursue these goals of brilliance in the basics. And if you're not in, then get your ass out of here.
Yeah, but and this is where I'm pessimistic because that warfighting culture of 1942 and 43, first it was flawed in and of itself, but they were not afraid to engage for the most part. That hasn't been in the surface Navy for I don't know how many years. You know, when I was at the Naval Academy in the 80s, the hardened edge of the Navy was the POW community. Those were the guys that were the heroic part of the Navy at that time. The SEALs were so tiny that there was almost no presence there, and we almost never really discussed. The surface force was seen as sort of fat and slovenly, and submarines were very, very technical. I mean, Rico was there at that time. And so there, I don't know that there's a true warfighting culture in the service community. There are absolutely bright spots in it. I mean, I cite one, I can't remember the guy's name. It was the CEO of Spartanburg County. 2 weeks after he comes in, he's in a fog bank, got people out there taking soundings going through an unmarked reef. I mean, that sounds like a big deal, but I got to tell you, that guy, he had a freaking wheelbarrow for his balls as far as I was concerned.
Right.
You know, I thought we were going to scrub the whole thing. So they're out there, but I don't know that it's systemic or cultural in that part of the Navy.
Okay, so when we identify, if we take equipment off the list in terms of outlining the problem, what, in your opinion, is the number one problem to solve?
Yeah, are you gonna look in and do a deep look and be willing to say culture, or are you gonna do a Band-Aid and hope it goes away and say, oh, we need to get more sleep.
Right? Okay. All right. Let's just
culture on that side, and then policy on the other side. You've got to do your deployment and presence on a bottom up, not a top down look. Here's what we got. Where are we going to take risks? And I think that's a hard discussion to have.
With the culture, with the culture that hasn't had that discussion in a long time and doesn't know that culture, right?
Yeah, it would be too strong to say they haven't had it, but I don't know that we've truly been willing to knock heads and say, this is the hard choice, here is the risk, and here's how it's going to come out. The more risk we take, here's how we can see it, it's going to leak out. Are you willing to accept those things? I don't know. Those guys are smart guys and they're mature guys. And I didn't sit in those kind of meetings. You would hope that they'd have those kinds of discussions. But that being said, we continue to dump requirements on people. So I don't know. But the hardest part is, you know, how did General Gray figure out that we needed to change the warfighting doctrine? We needed to change how we educated people. And how did he get that so that now that is a deep part of our culture? Was he playing on something that always had been there and he made some minor modifications that people got, or did he really cut deep? And we lived through it, but it's a little bit hard to figure out. And so can the Navy, is there an Al Gray that can look inside and say, we've got some deep cultural problems here, and it's not little band-aid things that get people 3 hours more sleep or something like that. Can you do that? And then can you engineer, you know, don't forget the Navy's big and it's diverse. It's harder to do. Is there a caliber of leader that can do that and then execute it and get it through the fiber of the entire organization? And then, I mean, it's hard. More cultural transformations in large organizations fail than succeed by an astronomical number.
Right.
It's hard to do. But, you know, maybe they're on the cusp of really falling off the edge of the cliff.
I don't know how you argue that they're not already over it. I mean, what else has to happen? How do you argue that they haven't gone over the cliff? I mean, two SEALs are been accused of murder in the midst of all this, these events, you know, two, what, RF-18 pilots, up at Whidbey Island think it's going to be funny to, you know, to, draw a cock in the sky with a set of balls. That's going to be funny. You know, it's just going to be one more statement of a Navy that's out of control. Doesn't get it.
And what I wouldn't want to happen is just have the immediate reaction of reduce risk everywhere. Because that actually just increases risk in the long term.
Right. No, it doesn't. Let me just tell you, your analogy to General Gray is a great one, because somebody needs to find that guy within the American Navy and needs to install him in a position of authority. And then they need to do what General Barrows did, is say, hey, look, if you can't be part of this, get out of here right now. And they need to go through a purge in terms of, yeah, we don't need you. 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 Just get out of here. Just go away. And so I think that and then that culture, it has to, you know, interestingly enough, I don't think the Navy's culture has to go to a place it's never been. It needs to return to its historical origins. General Gray took the Marine Corps someplace it had never been, a different way. And so does the Navy need a different way? Do they need, I would argue that they need to return to their seagoing, hard nose, tough standards, of years past.
Yeah, I mean, define that culture first and see through the sort of myths of the mythology of those times and really define what it is. And then, how do we get there? Because you can get there. It's really people. It's not systems or anything like that. And you have the raw material to be able to do it. Do you have the institutional wherewithal to make those hard choices. And under the previous secretary, they absolutely wouldn't have done anything like that. I don't know the current secretary. Generally, I have no idea. I believe that Secretary Mattis would be absolutely supportive of it. And dealing with the president can be challenging. This is probably a level below him. You know, it's probably within the building. But there's going to be demands on the Navy going forward brought down from the president that you've got to comply with, right? He gives the orders. You know, doing interesting theoretically, you know, the Argentinians lost the submarine last month.
Right.
What would happen if the U.S. had a submarine disappear off the face of the earth? You know,
well, we've
are we close to having something like that?
We've had it happen before, right?
A long time ago.
The Thresher?
When they were, I would say submarine technology in those days was still a little bit experimental, maybe. You know, we haven't had anything like that since, I think, the Thresher, which I think was in the 50s, maybe it was in the 60s. That was a long time.
Right.
I mean, would that send enough of a shockwave? Is that what it's going to take? Is it going to take a small, I don't know. I think if the Navy had a ship sunk in combat in the Gulf by one of those, I mean, I don't know what that would do or not. We would just rise up and take it out of the Iranians without maybe looking inside or so. I don't know. But, yeah, you would think there's enough INW out there that we have a genuine cultural problem. So maybe you got to do something overt to get people's attention and to try and buy yourself a little time. So you fire a three-star, you do some of that. But are you willing to look truly inside and say, this is our problem? And with... the secretary should be able to, he's new. But those 3- and 4-star admirals, and there's a whole lot of them, you know, I don't know.
To me, you know, there's an education component. Somebody's got to take over. This Navy version of General Gray has to take over the schools in the Navy, and they need to be about this change in the United States Navy. They need to be very about this change. And again, I think it goes back to embracing the discipline that the Navy needs to embrace.
And again, Mac, not to be overly pessimistic, but let's look at ourselves. You know, one of the things that we say is the absolute most important thing that we do in the Marine Corps is recruit training, right? And every 20 years, we got to go in there and tear recruit training apart because we fucked it up.
Right.
You know? How do we get a drill instructor to stuff a guy into a freaking dryer? How do we have so many substantiated hazing allegations? And we know how to do that right. It's central to our ethos as a Marine Corps, is recruit training. And we allow ourselves to be distracted and be stupid about it every 20 or 30 years. 20 or 30 years in the life of an organization is not a long time.
Right.
You know? I was at the Naval Academy, General Barrow was a cabin. You know, it's not that long ago that General Barrow had to rip the Marine Corps apart to fix it. And I don't know that we're jumping up and down now about the stuff that's going on down there, or went on down there. I don't think that we are. But God damn, how can we allow that to happen?
Well, again, it's... I had a guy named John Stevens on the program, and he wrote a book about the Ribbon Creek event. And I wanted to have him on because, I mean, I heard about Ribbon Creek, but I didn't really know the details about it. And, you know, and he talked about, you know, the environment of recruit training and what the incident surrounding Ribbon Creek and what actually happened and whatnot. You know, it was fascinating. You know, Chesty Puller agreeing to testify for the prosecution and ultimately aiding the defense as he kind of unannounced changes his testimony when he's on a stand. And so
But again, like other things that we've talked about today, it's not the recruits that are the problem, right?
No.
It's these, and again, this is from Barney Barnum. This is from Jarvis Lynch. Guys that have been, you know, that have been series officers and commanders down there. If you don't get out, if you're so absorbed by your computer and whatever, and those drill instructors don't know you and you don't know them, then they said, then you get what you get. And until the Marine Corps lays the wood to a regimental commander, to battalion commanders, and to sergeant majors, and that message is firmly blasted out into everywhere, that we're missing the message. We're missing the message, yeah, and it's going to happen again.
Did you read the article in the Gazette this month about recruit training?
I did not. I have not yet.
Yeah, dude, it's good. I think General Clint wrote it. I mean, it's good. And one of the things he talks about, and this is a cultural failure of ours, who are the battalion commanders at Pierce Hall?
From my reading, a lot of support MOS guys.
Yeah, typically there's a battalion that's reserved for a lawyer. They're not the best people we got.
Right.
We're not our culture. We allowed our culture to get a little bit sideways, and say the needs of these particular individuals is more than the needs of the whole. So we can fail at this. I think the Navy has got to look hard. And are they willing to change our culture? And if they are, it's a long-term process, right? They got some quick wins. Fired the 3-star out there, but I think it's going to be hard.
That's all eyewash.
But if they
don't, that's all eyewash. In my opinion,
yeah,
it makes people happy. We feel good about today.
You got to do it,
right? You got to do it.
But then are you
what happens
look
tomorrow?
Inside.
Right.
And are you going to have a genuine campaign? Because if not, we should expect this type of stupidity, you know, on a more frequent basis. And then the current secretary, that will not be acceptable. You know, and then we'll have a purge. Right?
Okay, here's a couple of emails for you, and then I'll let you go. I've taken up about an hour and a half of your time. And Gunner gets mad if I don't get him on time. The email number one, how will we know that the Navy is, one, pointed its nose in the right direction, and two, taking the appropriate action?
I think it would be easier to know if they're not doing it. If they just do this flash and then we go back to doing business, that won't work. We'll know if there's sort of a comprehensive plan laid out with a problem statement up front, and if the problem statement starts out with Navy culture and not the fucking bullshit you see in the commercials and not all that, but if you can read a document and you can say, you know what, that guy did some soul searching and they're making a genuine effort, and they devote resources to it. Resources, mostly time, right? It takes time. It gets into schools, it gets into training, and it's enforced, then you'll know. That's going to be harder to figure out. You'll know they're not doing it if there's a flash and you don't hear anything about it. So.
All right, here's another one. Mac, interesting discussion. I think that DESRON commanders and every other type commander ought to be held responsible for the basics relative to a ship going to sea. I guess you're asking, what are the basics? Well, I would think navigation, engineering, damage control, firefighting, aviation operations, CIC, are the basics of that ship. If they're not qualified and they go to sea, to me, relieve the whole bunch of them. It's called inspecting. It's called insuring the product. The whole marine thing. Expect what you inspect. And the Navy's the Navy's great on systems with all these checklists and all this other bullshit. To me, that guy ought to have to sign a document that said these guys are ready to go to sea. Go get it on, boys. Once he signs that, then they ought to be certified. And if they go to sea and they're not certified, that guy ought to be taken to task for it, held accountable, and he's got to inspect. To me, it's not hard. The Navy already has many of these systems in place. They've just neglected them in favor of, I'm not exactly sure. Is it sexual harassment training? Is it sexual assault? Is it some other thing that's distracting them from blocking and tackling and brilliance in the basics? It's very puzzling and very disillusioning for those of us who have served in the Navy. Appreciate the comments on the show this morning.
Yeah, I think the Navy has, you know, great inspection regimens and all of that. I would say, though, to you, you know, when you were forward deployed, did every battalion that showed up look the same?
Oh, God, no.
Were some of them probably not ready?
Yes, many of them were not ready.
Yeah, so did we fire any regimental commanders or were some back at Camp Pelton and Camp Lejeune?
No, but you should. They should have. Should have certainly impacted on their fitness reports.
Because there's a lot of dead Marines. Yeah. Because battalions showed up out there and they weren't ready.
Yeah, if that was the case, Will, then to me that absolutely ought to have been communicated from whoever was forward to whoever, you know, ultimately the division commander signs, yeah, their deployment orders, right? Yeah, they're good.
I don't pretend to understand the Navy structure on that side. I believe that they've got inspection regimes that take all those things in. I don't know that they're not doing them anymore. I have no idea, but you can look at the product. I think they have some significant problems in their manning levels as they've attempted to become more efficient as opposed to more effective. And look, it's anecdotal, but I just look at pictures of ships that were underway now 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and I see rust on ships like that. I don't know. Is it cosmetic? I don't think so. But you used to be able to do everything you needed to do and take care of at least the outside skin of the ship. The chip paint and chip rust and put paint on it. Those are things that don't get pointed out, but I see them, and it makes me feel uneasy. There's something wrong there.
Okay.
INW. Yeah.
Final indications of warning. That's what INW is, so in case you don't know. Final question. What will be the first thing that we see to know that the Navy's on the right track?
Wow. I don't know that we'll necessarily see it.
Okay.
Because there just may be an internal purge. And that you'll never really know until you see the performance come out in time.
Okay, so when you say internal purge, what do you mean? Reassignment of senior officers within the Navy to get certain people to certain spots who we know are performers?
Yeah. 3 and 4 stars curtailed a little bit early. Other people moved around, and then lower. I mean, it's all statutory boards, so it's not like the CNO and the second have reached down there can manipulate the board, but a slightly different emphasis of people on those boards and who's getting selected, and then who's going to the commands. Those kinds of things you can't see. They'll be opaque. But if those things must happen to change culture, right? There are different sort of calibers and flavors of leaders at the command level. And if you start emphasizing one flavor over another, eventually, you know, the ship will turn. And we won't necessarily see that stuff. It may be just ancillary to a more overt program of, you know, internal reflection, problem definition, and problem solution. And again, if the problem solution is 17 new programs, well, then we're going to fail. If the problem solution is a genuine fundamental, these are the three things. And here's how we're going to execute those three things, and here's your resources I'm going to devote to those three things, and here's how you're going to be evaluating against those three things, then I think there's a better than even chance, you know, that they turn the ship and head in the right direction. It's hard. It's going to be hard.
All right. So the first thing, will we see any kind of blue ribbon meeting of the minds? Navy's going to put their heads together. Will that be eyewash, or will that be step two after the reassignment? Because these guys are now going to come together, and they're going to write the script for the rest of us.
They've done the investigations. I mean, what should happen is the CNO should have grabbed, like, you know, 12 guys from the fleet, from the N3, from these different places. They're considered smart guys and leaders, and they should be buried in the Pentagon somewhere with the door locked. And they're taking the results of these investigations and the SEAL thing and other things that the CNO is giving them guidance on. And, you know, they stuff pizzas under the door, and these guys produce a program. It takes, you know, a couple of weeks or a month, and you vet it around, and off you go with that. So that's not necessarily something that we're going to see. And I don't know how, I mean, the CNO at some point, the second half of the CNO, if they fundamentally believe this, they got to come out and lay it out as well. But I don't think there'll be some blue ribbon. If there's an open blue ribbon panel, blah, 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 with 62 recommendations, we're doomed, right? It ain't going to happen.
Well, let me just tell you, I don't necessarily agree with that. It depends who they choose to implement this. If they choose the right guys to implement whatever comes out, then it'll be well done. In my opinion, if they choose wrong, if they choose the guys from the same culture that are afraid and are going to skew towards not offending and are going to skew to less discipline and more cover your ass, then to me, it's the Navy is doomed. So to me, it's look, I remember Sparky Anderson saying, the smartest thing I do is right Johnny Bench's, Pete Rose, Davey Concepcion, Tony Perez, Ken Griffey, right, and down the list of guys. He had the horses. That's the smartest thing I do. If you don't get the horses to the right spots, then you can't produce the appropriate document. And I'll say this, to give General Gray does not get enough credit for what he did for the Marine Corps. You know, everybody remembers him as this kind of, you know, grandfatherly, gruff, tough guy. You know, General Gray, nobody, in my knowledge, has risen to higher rank in the Marine Corps, enlisted in Korea, private to sergeant or staff sergeant, and then second lieutenant to commandant. Nobody else has done that. He's a brilliant guy, and he affected this personality of punching people in the chest and things like that that people love to focus on. But he unleashed John Schmidt and guys like, and John Kelly was a part of that, and all the guys who got involved in maneuver warfare embraced Mike Wiley and brought him in where he could, although Wiley's a polarizing figure. Guys like Tony Zinni, all were a part of that and changed the culture, and that's what the Navy's looking for. So, interesting. All right, I got to call Mike. We'll do this again. When there's something concrete that comes out, will you come back and talk about it again?
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
All right.
Send my regards to the gunner.
I will. Will Cosentini. Beat Army.
Beat Army.
Oh, there you have it. We're going to take a quick break. Will Cosentini, smart guy. I told you. More of Armoring Radio coming up next.